So I'm probably sitting in the hottest room in the entire house.
That's one way to do it.
I've got to get my desk fan sorted out. It's arriving tomorrow. Wow. A day too late.
And it's going to be only 3 more days, and then it'll be back to the big grey again, I'm sure.
Well, exactly. It never lasts long in this country, does it? So
No, it doesn't. So tell me. It's been a while since we had you on the show, and there's been so many developments. I've referred to it as a kind of quickening. A kind of quickening of the agenda and events, and that they seem to be almost orchestrated to occur and to accelerate. It's almost like we're waiting for a big crescendo. What's your take?
Yeah, I think you're right. It does feel as though things have shifted into another gear, doesn't it? And, you know, I think when we last spoke, we were talking a fair amount of, you know, the aftermath of the, you know, G7, G20. You do get the feeling that the policymakers are getting a bit desperate, you know, and the events leading up to the UK referendum, I think, highlighted this, you know, this incredible deployment of Project Fear, which, you know, has been, I think, you know, significantly rejected. And the aftermath of that, and, you know, you look what's going on in Japan, Bank of Japan now. You know, we're reverting back to fiscal policy, reverting that thing that was abandoned, largely abandoned by politicians years ago, is now being revisited because we are clearly reaching the limits of monetary policy to actually affect real economic reflation. And that's quite worrying because we've effectively wasted a number of years in pushing on a piece of string. You'd have to say the capacity for various states to actually support a more active fiscal policy is more limited, particularly, of course, in Japan, which is record.
And will QE fall under that as a fiscal policy? Because essentially this money has been created. It's basically dilution of everybody else's money. It's been created. But the only problem is largely it's gone into a certain set of hands. Are we suggesting that there might be a policy adjustment in terms of who gets that money? Will there be real citizen helicopter money? Or will it always be, and especially with forthcoming bank busts virtually now guaranteed. And in situ and well on the way, surely they're going to get the lion's share again?
I think it's possible, but I think, as I said, I think we have moved gear, and I think, you know, particularly given some of the vibe coming out of the new government in the UK talking about more social and economic inclusiveness. Now, this, of course, could be just complete cant. You know, it is coming from politicians after all, but I think that there is actually a genuine surprise by the elite that Project Fear didn't work. And I think there has been a period of disorientation. And I think they're sort of perhaps, you know, regathering. I mean, to really point of, you know, this cash circulating, you know, among a few hands, I think that's a perfectly valid observation. I mean, at the end of the day, QE is merely an asset swap with the central bank.
Exactly. So bad loan book for fresh cash.
Yeah, there's absolutely no guarantee that that's going to circulate in the real economy, and ultimately a lot of these lower financing costs have just allowed companies to engage in buybacks, engage in M&As, often with tax inversions, and in short, you know, we've gone through this sort of ground before. It's very fertile, I know, but what it basically means is this monetary largesse has basically accrued to the top 10 and more appositely the top 1% of the family. So it's been there to boost asset prices. Obviously, if you're rich, you own the majority of the assets, so you've become even richer. And the people who have been subject to Project Fair, to a large extent, I'm painting a very broad brush here, get whatever's left. And I think, and I can't remember the last time we spoke, I think that you know, so many political choices are presented as a carrot and stick. So let's say, you know, you want more money spent on the National Health Service. Now, you realistically know that probably means you're going to end up paying more tax. And for some people, that's a sensible trade-off. Now, I think with Project Fear, which obviously doesn't extend just to the UK, although it's the most recent exponent, most visible exponent of it, your choice was effectively between a stick and a bigger stick, and the person offering you the option is visibly eating all the carrots in front of you. You shouldn't be surprised if the person being offered that choice says, "I don't want to play that game. I'm going to take both of those sticks and start beating the current carrot-eating person over the head." And I think that's kind of what's happened. So yeah, we're in a different gear. I think it's still talking about helicopter money. I was quite interested. I mean, we were talking about this offline earlier, weren't we? About the latest asset management survey from Bank of America Merrill Lynch, and there's a highest expectation, I think, on record of helicopter money being deployed by a major central bank within the next 12 months. I think that's up to almost 40% now, and that's come from pretty much nowhere. And equally, the perception, at least, that fiscal policy, and obviously there's a fiscal dimension to helicopter money, is too restrictive. That's come from nowhere a year ago to now suddenly all these, genii suddenly realizing that fiscal policy is actually too restrictive. That's now at a record. So again, as I said, we come back to the same thing. I don't want to bang on about it too much, but I think there's a growing realization that what has been tried isn't working. The new tools are going to come out. It's increasingly desperate. But the other thing is, I just draw this one last point, is I think it also throws a lot of responsibility back to political actors. And this is a space which they vacated years ago, basically because they didn't want the responsibility. They shifted it all to central banks, shifting back to them. But of course, I think that, again, their capacity to actually administer it, deal with it, deal with the political consequences of it, their own, own political support base. I mean, look what's going on within the Labour Party in the UK right now. That's hilarious. Yeah, I mean, if you ever wanted confirmation that political parties aren't popular movements, you only have to look at what's going on there. So it's a mess, I think, is all I can say. It's a mess, and I honestly can't see any coherent thought together as how we're going to get the global economy moving, how we're going to get growth up, how we're going to get productivity up, and most importantly, how we're going to see a more egalitarian, a more widespread distribution of that wealth creation. I just can't see it happening at the moment. All I can see is a lot of flailing about, and not much real progress, even if we're closer to identifying what the problem is.
And it seems because we haven't spoken since the Brexit
No.
outcome. The last time we spoke was pre-Brexit, and sometime before. And it seems to me, I'm just interested in going back and revisiting this.
Yeah.
Nobody wanted of the Brexit team to follow through and become a leader of the party on any scale. It's almost like everyone. It's almost as if everyone who led the Brexit, who had any sort of profile, Farage, Johnson, Gove, it's almost like they had to be seen to fail themselves or to rule themselves out. In the end, we got left with a lady that nobody knew prior to the Conservative Party leadership runoff, called Leadsom, largely, unless you were a policy wonk and a real politician follower. To represent Brexit as a potential leader. So it was almost as if I the conspiratorial side of me says that Farage and all of these people were told, okay, you've had your day in the sun, but whisper in the ear, get any delusions about running the show and you'll see how quickly your wheels come off.
Yeah, I think
And
that was certainly true of Farage. I mean, I think he got frozen out immediately after the vote. He said, "Well, you've been useful in pushing this through, but we don't want to know you anymore." And he was complaining quite bitterly that he said, "Well, what am I going to do? What have I got to do in order to actually have a seat at this table?" And the good answer, of course, was he was never going to get it. And so, of course, now he's retired from UK politics, you'd have to say. I wonder how long that'll last. So I think that's is that two resignations now or three resignations last 8 years? I kind of lost count. The whole issue with Boris Johnson and Gove was interesting because it was very clear, wasn't it, that Boris just disappeared.
But he looked ruffled and disheveled, yeah. And I've never seen someone win a cause and look like they've just been shot in the foot.
Boris always.
In other words, no, but I mean, this was beyond his usual baffling buffoonery. This was someone who was in a state of shock and very dazed and confused and deer in headlights, had no idea of what to do next and couldn't find a way to fast enough that just took the spotlight off him quick enough, you know. And I saw quite a few Remainers, because he was at one point mayor of London, and London being the big Remain camp, were, you know, venting a lot of spleen directed at Boris. I saw this repeated in many, many times. So it was almost like by being in London, having been a mayor, and then successfully led a Brexit campaign, he was almost abashed and ashamed of what he'd done, as if he'd, you know, he'd done some form of paedophilic act and been caught on camera with it. You know, he just couldn't rule himself fast enough. This whole thing with Gove, and Gove's this masterful backstabber and all of this. Boris, from the outcome, I saw those early footage. He didn't look happy at winning at all.
Yeah.
And he didn't know what to say.
Well, there was two things. I mean, one, I think there was plenty of spleen being vented by Remainers anyway. I mean, I was honestly quite shocked by just how vitriolic some of these people were. I mean, I spent that Friday morning of you know, the immediate post-referendum, hosting a well-known economist that will remain nameless, but she was apoplectic and saying that, you know, some people shouldn't be
given a voice,
vote, and you know, how stupid can they be, and why should we, weren't we stupid to have released that number showing that the UK population had increased by 500,000 during the last year? We shouldn't have released it at that time, even though of course it would have been scheduled, it was just scheduled to be released then. And it was just the sheer, I don't know, it was arrogance,
utter anti-democracy, utter don't tell them what they need to know, spin them a yarn so that we get the outcome we want. So people love democracy until they get an outcome they don't like. It's absolutely amazing how they become extremely anti-democratic and everyone else is an idiot. Well, I mean, I've even read something about Churchill, referendums are dangerous. You know, have you ever spoken to the average, spend 5 minutes to speak to the average voter? And my view would actually be politicians are dangerous. Have you ever taken the last 5 minutes to speak to politicians? Because, I mean, you know, every single war we've gone on, the Iraq war and everything, has been put forward by, if we'd had a referendum on that, we'd not have gone into Iran and Iraq. Actually, basic, big picture, common sense, a large group of people, which will contain smart and dumb people in proportion, are actually more led by instinct, more accurately than most of the political decisions. I don't want to over revisit. It's long after Brexit, and that story is meant to be dead and gone. But I was just curious to your take on that, and it just seems. I just wonder. Do you think there was something behind it that everyone in Brexit suddenly disappeared into the ether, and no one who campaigned or had any profile for this could be seen to be rewarded, let alone even be involved in the race? They didn't even get to have their hat thrown in. Boris very quickly is ruled out, saying, oh, I've been backstabbed. Well, no, you won't. Just run and get someone else to run your campaign if you really want it.
Yeah,
but he just showed no appetite for actually really wanting it and having a convenient scoop. Gove's done me over. Okay, I'm checking out. That's terrible. I'm going to go lick my wounds and wait until this is all done.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, I think that, you know, Boris, I mean, are you suggesting that Boris's wings were, he was basically told not to?
I think a number of people could not be allowed to have seen to have gained having led the Brexit successfully any further. That was, you've had your moment, matey, and you back the right the hell down. Otherwise, you're going to get the media bombardment from hell and gone. Every little closet affair you've had, everything, you want to start running and getting ambitions and big ideas, then prepare for this. We'll take over from here about who gets to run off. And it became very clear very early that May, was going to be, I mean, it was almost like, I talk about this in life, sometimes just to succeed in trading, as you know, in trading, I'm a big fan and technical analyst and trader and teach people. I say, sometimes you just have to keep showing up.
Yes.
You know, you don't have to have the talent. You just have to keep showing up. In Theresa May's case, it's almost like an accelerated version of that. Everyone just stood in the ring, and everyone around her was either shot or stabbed and murdered without doing a single thing. There were just a carnage of bodies around her. And she, and by virtue of being the last person standing, they just said, well, here you go. I suppose you get the crown then.
It reminded me, Francis.
You know, Cameron shooting himself effectively shot Boz. Oh, this is like Hamlet, you know. Cameron shoots himself. He shoots Osborne in the face by virtue of association. Boom, two guys drop dead, thunk. Gove stabbing Boris, stabs himself because now he's seen as a devious maverick. So those two just sit there in an embrace of self-slaughter, and they collapse to the floor. Then boom, bosh, bosh, the one candidate that did come up, they makes a comment about something about how it's different if you've had children or married. The media just turns on her and just slaughters her for, you know, she just had to open her mouth and they found something that they could just hang her with. So she was convicted and hung, and then quickly stepped down out of the race before even a race had even started. And May just sort of stood there in the middle of the ring. It's like having a WrestleMania with, you know, when they do those 20 guys, last man standing wings, and you don't even have to, you don't touch anybody, everybody else. So, I mean, it was such a contrived leadership run. It was such a, it was quite clear that there was someone behind scenes who said, this is whom it should be. For the reasons of.
Well, I remember us discussing it certainly offline. I don't think we did it in the last podcast, but I think you said that that May was positioning herself to be the compromise candidate, and she made one, you know, extremely feeble speech in favour of Remain on the grounds of national security, and then disappeared. Instead of, you know, Theresa May, it was Theresa MIA, you know, missing in action.
Yeah,
and you know, and then she sort of turned, as you say, turns up after everybody was slaughtered.
Yeah, just don't get involved in the scrap. Maintain a low profile, and cometh the hour, cometh the man type thing.
Exactly. And to say, you know, use the sort of various sort of WrestleMania and whatever. It reminded me, I can't remember which one there's, but there's a Pink Panther film where all the various, you know, secret services of the world try to kill Inspector Clouseau. You know, the CIA. Got the KGB, and they end up killing each other, and he's bumbling around.
Yeah,
doesn't even know that they're targeting him, and at the end of it, you know, he's got this pile of bodies. He's still standing there, and they go, "God, this guy's a genius."
Yeah,
he still doesn't know what's happened.
Yeah, exactly. It is a Pink Panther sketch. It's straight out of the Monty Python Pink Panther book. Anyway, moving all aside from that Brexit, I don't want to derail us from now. We are here now, and we all know what has happened since. So where are we with the banks? Where with the Deutsche Bank narrative? It now seems like it's open season. You know, we were talking about this. People still were shaking their heads and thinking we're nuts when we first started with that bank is bust. It's going to need a bailout. Now we're having Italian politicians. We're having the IMF. We're having everybody coming out and saying, you know, this is an epileptically large event. I mean, it's so much bigger than a Lehman that people don't realize that the resounding bust, if people had a liquidity squeeze around Deutsche Bank, is that we would go into a 5 times, a 10 times 2008 type event. But now people are talking about it quite openly. I'm getting into this parallel world. I used to exist in this bipolar world where there was my world, where there was an inevitability that no one else saw, and I felt insane, and I had to find a very select small group of people that I could talk about these things with, and mentioning them around others just annoyed them. They couldn't see it and stop being negative. You know, it's as if it was a negative thing, knowing what's coming and preparing for it so that you can best serve yourself and your family. To actually, the two worlds are merging now. There's a lot of things getting out, the corruption. Everyone's largely in the US accepts that Hillary is an utter, complete criminal.
Yeah.
But now it's a case of, and so what? We don't care. She's still up for election. The FBI waves it through because upsetting the Clinton cartel, this FBI head, it's like I saw one of those tweets that went out. sure, she's a criminal. Sure, she did this, but I ain't going to be the one to stop her. I don't want to end up dead, you know, for the FBI head Kofi. It seems like everybody's in on the joke now. Everyone's getting it. It's like the two polar worlds are now actually merging together. And yeah. And the amazing thing for me now is I no longer have to talk and wonder who I'm speaking to. Are they enlightened or not? The amazing thing is we're not reacting to the fact that we're about to elect a criminal, a drug runner, potentially, as head of the US. We're not reacting to the fact that the central banks are absolutely at sea and have no flipping idea anymore. Yeah. And that failure is imminent. It's just a question of, do we deflate first and then go fail, or will there be a period of inflation depending on what policy decisions they use for this remaining little corner that we're painted in to fill in the final few tiles before we are actually, you know, we're caught out.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's certainly the case that, you know, so-called authority figures, policymakers have, their authority has eroded very, very rapidly in the post-crisis environment. I mean, we can blame bankers and we can blame lax regulators for what happened in and around Lehman. But I mean, I think it's very clear, increasingly clear as time goes on, that the rot goes much further than that. And, you know, as you've alluded to, as I mentioned earlier on in this podcast, you know, a lot of the heavy lifting has been expected of central bankers. It's very clear they have, as you say, no clue what's going on. They can't forecast anything. They're running out of policy ideas, and it's being pushed back to even more clueless politicians whose affiliation to democratic principles, you'd have to say, is somewhat suspect. And just to take up the thread also about you know, some people having ideas about just how deep this rot goes. I was quite interested after the events in Turkey over the weekend to read in Forbes magazine, of all places, and it's not exactly a hotbed of radical thought, suggesting that maybe this coup was stage managed by President Erdogan in order to exact a purge of the judiciary, a purge of the finance ministry, basically any remaining power centers that might oppose him. You know, because clearly what's going on there, it has been premeditated. And you know what? If the Forbes is coming up with that, then that just tells you it's mainstream. It's gone mainstream.
It has.
And then you've got this this issue about feeling that the political party, because at the moment, I think all Western powers are effectively based around the idea of parliamentary representative democracy in its sort of broadest terms. But at the point where the political parties are no longer deemed to be representative and that the whole democratic process as we understand it is skewed, then you're thinking, well, what do we want to play that game, particularly where we're not even getting, we're not getting anything out of the system? And, you know, just going back to something I think we did discuss in the previous podcast, is if you've got an environment where people don't feel that the world is going to be a better place for their children, when you don't have a stake in the system in the form of a house because you can't afford it, or even a job, we're not even talking about careers anymore. We've moved on from careers. We went to careers, we briefly had jobs, and now we've got gigs.
Yes, you know, that's an interesting line. I like that. Well, from careers to jobs to gigs.
Yeah.
The so, 0 hour contract for a couple of weeks and then big gaps while you scrounge another hot desking minor. Whenever we've got downtime, you can get a cup of, but an hourly rate. Wow. Yeah, that's a good parallel.
And then you'll
have
policymakers who will say, well, we need to keep these, you know, the wealth creators, and I use that word in inverted commas. You know, we need to keep them on board because they're the only people, creating wealth. You know, we need to mollycoddle. It's a sort of Ayn Rand, you know, blessed are the wealth creators because they will create wealth. Well, do you know what? They're not creating as much wealth as they were by a long stretch, and they seem to be grabbing most of it. In fact, nearly all of it. And, you know, going back to the, again.
Well, it's financial engineering now. You know, that's the wealth creators. Well, but they're not really creating wealth. They're just reappropriating it into one corner of the room.
Yeah. Well, again, central banks are willing participants in that because, you know, what business has the ECB got in buying up the corporate bonds of Telecom Italia?
Well, this is what shocked me most about that reaction is that nobody saw that as the major biggie. I said the biggest thing, I did a YouTube clip specifically on that.
Yeah.
Governments now buying private companies' debt. This is a change in thing. Since when is a central bank a liquidity provider for private corporate bonds?
Yeah, it's nuts. I mean, one of the reasons, of course, was that because of the budget restrictions, which effectively the northern countries within the European Union have, is that they're running out of government bonds. One of the reasons why the ECB can't step up the purchase of sovereign bonds any further is in Germany they'll run out of bonds in the next year, 18 months. So they
why
have
are
to,
they not borrowing enough as a government? Are they
well,
actually...
exactly. All the it's totally asymmetric. So you know Germany needs to expand its deficit and its demand, run down that current account surplus, which is 8% of GDP now, and it's enormous. And is it, again, it's effectively exporting deflation, as is China. So I brought another issue in here, and all the burden of adjustment has fallen on Club Med, generically Club Med, and that's it's an economic road to nowhere. But the thing is, I don't see what Plan B is. You know, now that Plan A is visibly failed, what is Plan B? And I think it's, you know, my worry is that because there is no Plan B, that somebody somewhere does something stupid, really stupid, and I'll leave that sort of statement dangling enigmatically in the air. But I am quite worried about the geopolitical. It's quite interesting, as I said, going back to this Bank of America Merrill Lynch Asset Managers survey. The biggest single risk that professional investors, and again, these are mainly people who would have voted Remain, yeah. Is geopolitical risk, and of course that's a broad church, but you know it's even occurred to them, and maybe the whole Brexit episode was a wake-up call for some of these people living in their hermetically sealed bubbles, that there's a societal problem now. All these economic social experiments, etc., which have been played out increasingly unsuccessfully over successive years, is really having a corrosive effect on society, and society is the 99% is starting to react in an unpredictable manner, and some people aren't going to like that, and it's not going to be confined to, you know, Remainers accosting you as they did on that first Saturday morning at a hairdresser's. I thought he was going to pick a pair of scissors up and stab me in the neck. We're going to see. I think we're going to see some reactionary move, and I don't know where it's going to come, and I don't know quite what the trigger is. But I think it's very, very clear to me that the world is a much less safe, a much less stable place than we would have liked to have.
And central bankers started it all. You know, you go look at 1913. This is the thing I've looked at: the corrosive element of adding debt as a expanding of the economy structure creates higher volatility in the economy, not lower volatility. So what you get is bigger booms and rushes, which is human nature playing out. So you get easier access to credit, then you get asset inflation, so you get everyone speculating, so you get a melt up till you reach a point where your quality of credit is so bad you get a bust. Then to reinflate, you start lending in another sphere. So that might have been .com, and everyone was quitting their jobs to become a share trader in the US in 1996, 7, 8, 99, etc. into 2000. Boom, next thing they knew, they were all running into being property speculators and flipping Miami condos. And they're all on the new lending bubble. Now we've got the echo property bubble. We've got the subprime car bubble and the student loan bubble to try save the extreme depression and lack of economic activity brought in by the downswings and the pain that we pay for all the excessive happy days we got when we were all high as kites on credit. And this has all been a function of the people controlling the credit. In other words, the liquidity providers to the economy, which has been the central bankers. They yep. are the core reason, with the support of the commercial banking, that we yep. are due And we have saved, supposedly, and I say saved inverted commas, we've saved nothing. All we've done is we've just gone into a paranormal virtual reality that has no real justification with this quantitative easing printing, the real crash that we need. And the longer we've saved it, we've made it more guaranteed in terms of its outcome and more severe.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I mean, you know, to go back to what we covered, I think, in considerable depth in the first series of podcasts, I think there was incomplete liquidation in the immediate post-crisis years, sort of 2009, 10, 11, because it was politically unacceptable to do so, you know. I mean, because who are the people who are going to lose the most? Well, the people who already had the most, and the people who had the most were basically part of the same class that were making policy. So, you know, Turkey's never voted for Christmas. And now we are where we are, you know, eight years up the road. And it always amazes me that the narrative is still, well, there's insufficient demand. The reason why the world isn't growing is there's insufficient demand. Well, bearing in mind that the incremental demand is going to come from the 99%. It's not going to come from the 1% because, you know, unless you're Philip Green, you don't need three yachts. Whereas, you know, BHS shareholders, if they actually had a proper pension, I'm pretty sure that money sooner or later is actually going to be circulating in the real economy. So where are we now? We're here where productivity growth is grinding to a halt, which means that long-term economic growth is grinding to a halt. Population still increasing globally. So the only question is who gets what? And the answer increasingly seems to be, well, the 99% get little or nothing. And in fact, you know, if we carry on the way we are, things are going to get a lot worse for them on an absolute basis, never mind relative basis, because that's already happening. And we're going to have to see. I just hope that, you know, some of the people in the top 1% have very good security, because, you know, this is the stuff of revolutions. I don't think this is, you know, alarmist at this stage.
No doubt in my mind that the violently rich families are already, I mean, Rockefeller had his sixth heart attack. Operation in his private home. So just imagine the kind of home that is a better place for having a heart transplant than a major hospital on an island. So these guys are going to be hunkering right the hell down when the turmoil phase comes. The thing is, how do they control the leadership that they're putting out, the front men, the Blairs and the Clintons of this world, and that they don't get taken down when the anger is there? Because the anger is going to be there.
Yeah.
And they're hoping to contain that or distract it and channel it into a war. That's the only conclusions I can come to. I don't know quite what else to think.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, you just get it's just clear that something is going to give. The course we're on at the moment is unsustainable. And as somebody famous, whose name I can't remember, once said, if something can't go on forever, it will stop. One way or the other, it will stop. And as I said, we have gone into another gear.
I said that, but I probably wasn't the first.
I think so. We said
if something can't continue, therefore it will end. and I think it's very much the case now.
Sort of quote, but I don't think it is. I mean, I think ultimately, you know, the thought that I had, and I don't know if I mentioned it last time around, is that there's an increasing credibility gap for what we would now, in this day and age, consider to be the market capitalist system. One, I would say there is no market. There's clearly no market when you've got central banks going out buying corporate bonds and sovereign bonds and so on, and trying to talk things up and talk things down. You know, it's a rigged market in that respect, and all the sort of pricing signals that you would otherwise get are just completely damped down until they explosively reappear. So forget about the market. Yeah. And the market can be wrong anyway. Yeah. I mean, look, hilariously, the Brexit vote is like, well, you know, we're just going to follow the bookies because the bookies got it right in the general election in the UK last year. I mean, that was pathetic. Yeah. Pathetic. As well, at the end of the day, the whole idea of having a market and that pricing mechanism is that resources are efficiently allocated. Yeah, and even if that means that there are some losers and some winners, and then again, you go back to a lot of the anxiety that's been evidenced again in and around the Brexit vote, but these are global issues about blue collar workers losing out to again generically people in China. And you could say, well, oh, that's great because even though wealth within current countries is diminishing, wealth between countries is increasing. Wealth between countries is actually diminishing. So you say, well, globalization is working. And you go, well, one, that's of no comfort to somebody in Scunthorpe, for argument's sake, who's losing their job to somebody in Shanghai. And two, with productivity growth having collapsed, and that's not hyperbole, it's collapsed over recent years. I would say it's very clear that resources are not being efficiently allocated for any number of reasons. And ultimately, we're going to hit a wall. Economically, we're going to hit a wall, which means socially, we're going to hit a wall, which means politically, we're going to
That's
hit
the
a wall.
knock-on thing, isn't it? That's the knock-on thing that once you have the assuredness, and it's a bit like if something cannot continue, this is where everyone doesn't join the final dot. Therefore, it has to end, which is the statement you made. In the same way, if we have the financial Armageddon that we will have, that we have said has to come to an end, and we'll have the reset. Therefore, then, the social, the militaristic, the geopolitical, everything structurally as it has been arranged will no longer look the same post-event.
So
And
yeah,
people aren't planned
for
for
pieces of
the cascade, the cascading an event of this. It really, really is. It's like pouring the champagne castle with the one all into the one at the top, and someone swinging a baseball bat through the bottom layer. The top glass doesn't levitate
Yeah, exactly.
and stay in good condition. When the foundation of something is destroyed, the entire pile comes down, and that is everything that is contingent on a functioning financial system will break in a way that it can never be pieced together again in its then form. So this is a Teutonic plate movement. You're getting the tension building up, tension building up. It's at an all-time high. There's a crescendo of fake terrorist and real terrorist and who knows what terrorist and activities and criminals running for president. It's kind of, as a technical analyst, I would say, when you have that final melt-up of a boom that should never have been. If you remember the dot-com boom, the last few months where it just went apoplectic, it was going up so much every single day. It was becoming ridiculous, and it was kind of a bit like the property market. It's like that last moment of craziness prior to a new reality coming on. So where you then go from, being 4,500 to later being at 800 on the Nasdaq, in the space of months. And the people just can't quantum the rate of descent, and the destruction is so fast that people's mental capacity, the parentheses around which their reality exists, need to expand at such a rapid rate. Things that they've assumed, things that we take for granted, things that we thought would always work, suddenly cease to work.
I mean, I think you're right, and I think when you say not making that last connection, I think this is where cognitive dissonance sets in, because it leads you to somewhere which is deeply uncomfortable at the emotional and cognitive level, and so you just don't, your brain just shorts itself out, and you'd have to say that we're in a world where people, all sorts of people, for various reasons ostensibly commercial reasons, are very keen to provide you with distractions. So of course, I've been asked to comment recently about this whole Pokemon Go situation, which you're thinking, well, goodness me, here's another element of bread and circuses, where we're all expected to scurry around under the GPS umbrella, picking up virtual stuff, virtual shinies, because there's nothing left in real life to actually go go for. You know, maybe we should adopt that as currency, Francis.
I think my view is enjoy life now.
Yeah.
Do whatever. Have fun.
Yeah.
Definitely stack silver, in my opinion, and any other precious metal that prefers. I mean, if you of such vast means that you want to keep it condensed, get your gold in. But the silver will go up in percentage terms more. Play, laugh, and have fun, and be ready just to live out 5 or 6 years in the Southern Hemisphere in case it all kicks off.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly.
And even if that means you go Airbnb to flip in New Zealand and you do, darn socks. and live in a nice countryside place where you have a couple of laying hens and you grow your own fruit and veg and you pay a menial rent to a farmer who's just delighted to get some income because there's been a drop in food demand, as there always is when you massacre a load of people and there's a depression. It's not so inelastic as people think. Just see it out, 5 years of your life. I'm actually planning, I'm mentally in my brain, there is going to be what I would call, what's that thing when you take a break at work and you go for a long period of...
Sabbatical.
That's the phrase I was looking. Thank you for bringing me out there. I'm talking about a 5-8 year sabbatical where I'll observe the globe from a safe distance. And hope to have as many of my family members that are dear to me ensconced with me and live a very simple, happy life and existence, going back to basics and roots where it's not all about, oh, crap, I've left my iPhone at home. I feel so disconnected. We're eating, we're living healthy, we're breathing air, we're learning a new skill, and we're having fun. And I'm a very cheap existence. And I'll continue, if there is such a thing as internet and the power's back up and the grid is back up, to serve people from all nations from a corner of the world, and just hope that that element doesn't get dragged in. Because I can't help but not see the masking of this event and the solution, because the people that have brought us to this point are also the people that will come with the solution. And that's the thing that irritates me. They just reset the cycle and put themselves at the top of the same tree again.
Well, I mean, I think you know, part of the answer, and you know, hopefully this podcast to some extent might help, is just for people to think for themselves. I mean, you know, one of the most depressing spectacles that I'm subjected to on a near daily basis is the commute in to work, because you know you have these people plugged into various instruments, just zoning out, and then just plodding around like zombies into work, and you know, I would never claim to have, any unique wisdom or unique insight, and certainly would never ever claim to, you know, feel that I know everything. But I do believe that discussing things with real people is very healthy, and it's very necessary to maintain a healthy democracy. I think it's very good to just maintain a sense of self and well-being. And it does worry me that, you know, you've got this situation where so many people just seem to be completely disengaged by really what is going on around them. And going into a job which is almost over-focused on one particularly tiny little piece in the puzzle, particularly the financial services industry, which is incredibly complex and interrelated. And not really seeing the picture, and actually getting to the point where you don't want to see the bigger picture because it becomes too painful. And that just leaves a vacuum for other people, other less scrupulous, and I would argue it's quite often less intelligent people to come in. I'm not sure I know you had this discussion offline before, but this idea that, you know, you've got these sort of evil genii out there, you know, like Inspector, you know, we're stroking the cat and saying, I've been waiting for you, Mr. Bond. I think a lot of the actors here have no real idea about the consequences of what they're doing.
I think they have an instinctive feeling that it's not going to be good, but they don't have, I don't think they've actually modeled in either their mind or certainly in a more elaborate way on paper the domino fall down effect in terms of social provision. I mean, just think of people that rely on social services who are handicapped for a nurse to come out and serve them. Just think when the salary payrolls stop getting made, for those that are on state soil? Who's going to pick up the pieces? Who's going to pick up all these? You're going to have heart-rending stories.
I think there's two things. I think one, I think an example of the lack of foresight would be, for instance, David Cameron. And again, I can't remember whether I said this on the last podcast. I've certainly said it elsewhere. I've always thought that David Cameron was a good tactician, but a bad strategist. And my goodness, we've seen him reap the whirlwind. You know, he made a series of tactically expedient political decisions. But all he did was build up a lot of left-hand tail risk, as people who look at markets might describe it. You know, this massive back tail, which then eventuated in the UK Brexit vote. So there's definitely that element there, to my mind, in play. Just lost my train.
Tell us about the cash that's sitting on the sidelines, Mike. Yeah. In other words, the recent developments and how it ties into how far have we got. The question everyone asks, how long have we got? Where are we in the game? No one can really say, okay, let me just get my diary out. All right, it's going to be the 23rd of September 2016. And on that single day, we're going to have the biggest market fall and then it's all going to precipitate from there. It's actually not a single day event. We are already in the collapse. You kind of skid, you scrape, you slide, and then you capitulate. You don't fall in a straight line, but you start losing control.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting because, of course, what's made the headlines in recent days has been, you know, a new all-time high on the S&P. But that of itself is indicative of the problem in many respects, because, you know, you've had this overweight call, for instance, of people to pile into European equity. That's been there for the last 3 or 4 years. Within that, you've had, as you know, this overweight call on European banks. That's been disastrous. So you've now had, again, people switching back desperately to US equity because it's the one large market where growth is half reasonable and it looks half sustainable. But it's pretty desperate. you've written off Japan, you've written off Europe. You know, you're probably bottom fishing around in emerging markets and you're going back to the US, which everybody says is overvalued anyway. You're buying tech, you're buying real estate because of the low interest rate environment. You know, you've got some really, really crowded trades out there. And this lack of diversity is like showing you how much pressure has built up in the system. And I think you're right. You know, you've had this corrosive effect of economically. We're seeing the political and social ramifications of that. And you're seeing that in terms of places of stress within the financial market. One area I would mention, I think we may have touched on this last time we spoke again, is high yield credit. Because high yield credit is the one asset class where I think most investment banks are pretty much united in saying that's an overweight. It's an overweight call. It's an overweight call. And high yield credit, despite, you know, the market volatility we've seen over recent weeks, has held up remarkably well. A market indication, and again, this is subject to all the caveats we've alluded to earlier in terms of this, you know, central bank inspired distortions of market pricing. But I would be looking for the next, shall we say, decisive downshift to be preceded by significant stress in the high yield segment.
It's always that way, isn't it? A little bit. But aren't they masking? We've got to remember there's protagonists here that are looking to contain here. So some of the original signals are always being masked. I mean, the USD JPY is a classic case. It's the fear index. Note how Bernanke is over there. The yen keeps getting stronger from when we shorted it and we said it was topping out at 124. On a head and shoulders, and that it was the beginning of the fear. We based the January fear element forecast that came about, and China, etc., part of that was a contributor to that. It gone lower, it traded below 100. Next thing, we have Bernanke over there trying to contain the natural fear index that is the USD JPY, and now Japan has to do QE again to destroy their own currency. Because, and remember, the currency is working against them for exports as an export-driven nation. Yet it's America being such an awesomely good guy dispensing economic advice on how to destroy your currency.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? I mean,
to give them an export advantage to the detriment of American companies, you know, in the USD JPY trade and other nations. Why would they, in this war to trash, this dash to trash, the currency wars, why does America care so much that a major fear index is getting out of hand? That is the question and the answer.
Yeah, it's strange. I mean, and it's not only, of course, you know, Japan, which is it's an ally, it's within the US sphere of influence, but also tolerating, you know, some pretty consistent moves by China to devalue its currency. I mean, that trend continues, and it'd be interesting to see whether this is even mentioned this week.
If you look multi-decades, Japan has worn the currency export disadvantage more than anybody else. In the early 80s, there were 680 yen to the pound. And we sit at 130 today. Yet they've continued to compete. No one, this is where I differ from Kyle Bass, no one has ever managed to maintain an export market in the space of 30, 40 decades of having your currency go up the better part of 4.5 times to the pound, probably 3 times to the dollar. You know, there was 280, 290 yen. And now, as I say, we've traded at 70.
Yeah.
You know, we traded just below 90 recently, 99 recently.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but there, in fairness, though, there is a mitigating factor, you know, not just for Japan, but for many countries which host, you know, large international companies as well, that they can embed their supply chain in weaker currency areas. So obviously, you know, a lot of the bigger players in Japan will have.
But you don't get to do that with everything.
Exactly.
I mean, if Kawasaki, Yamaha want to compete with Ducati, and the euro is falling.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen it. The Jap bikes just released the previous model with new stickers, and they lag on the R&D, and they just maintain a holding position in the market while the others innovate and expand market share.
Yeah.
Eventually, there's a level where it starts to hurt them, and it can't cost because they're still paying salaries. There's still a large amount of employment in those companies in the mother country.
Yeah.
It's not just the CEO and the CFO that sit in a room together and everything else can be remotely done. You're right, you can mask some of it, but you can't mask it all. It's fascinating, Mike, fascinating. What else? I wanted you to get on to the aspect of the report that was talking about cash holdings at all-time high. Tell us about that and then we wrap on that.
Yeah.
In terms of markets and how things are.
Well, yeah, it's just extremely fragile. So, for instance, can you hear me okay? Because you're breaking up a little on my side.
All right, I'm hearing you very strong.
Okay, right. Well, I'll just plow through. Okay, so this is the Bank of America Merrill Lynch Global Fund Managers Survey. It comes out monthly. They've been running this for, I think, about 15 years now. And it's very interesting. It's very comprehensive. So they're saying that these are professional investors. They're institutions. They're being hedge funds as well. So the cash levels are the highest since November 2001, which I think is the first year they actually ran this survey, but I might be wrong there. They said investor buying of protection against the sharp decline in stock market at a record high. First equity, this is global, obviously there are underweights and overweights within that. First equity underweight in 4 years. Yeah, it is marginal, but it is overall underweight. Growth profit expectations flat to negative, but at the moment, just 70% think recession likely. That is, of course, going up, so let's see where that goes. Most crowded trades, long quality stocks, long US, long EU credit, and short EU banks, your favorite subject. I think a helicopter money, I think I've mentioned this before, expectations next 12 months, 39% think a major central bank is going to roll out helicopter money, which I would take as being pretty desperate stuff. Over here, investors looking to short UK equities, highest since December 2009. First Eurozone underweight in 3 years. I mentioned that a bit earlier. That's been a disastrous overweight call. I never agree with it. I'm very happy I stuck to my guns.
What was that one? To be overweight Euro stocks?
To be overweight Euro stocks and be overweight Euro cyclical stocks, particularly banks.
Wow.
Banks were felt to be this massive value trade. They're very, very cheap. Well, do you know what? They keep getting cheaper.
Exactly. You see, this is the issue with fundamental analysis without any technical analysis.
Well,
there's no sign of recovery. All the setups are to the downside. It's all continuation. You know, these are the guys saying that Enron is cheap, you know, and not knowing about all the off-balance sheet items all over again, isn't it?
Well, as somebody who looks at the fundamentals, I would say it's a incredible failure of fundamental analysis
as well. It is that as well, and I agree, and I don't put them as one versus the other. In other words, the technicals are confirming that there's fundamentals that are not being appreciated in the fullest sense, so yeah. Absolutely, I would agree with that.
I'm just like seeing what else we got. So
cash is being held at an epic level by these fund managers. Now, there's a nifty 50 kind of thing going on with the NASDAQ and the big stocks, S&P
yeah.
making new highs. That should, and we have a technical analyst, a technical term for that, the lack of breadth. So that is also the beginning of the end of a melt-up bull
yes.
run.
Absolutely.
In that.
It's all being funneled into a few stocks. I mean, it's tech, real estate, pharma, US in terms of geography, and large swathes of the investment universe otherwise being deemed uninvestable.
To be clear also, if there's huge turmoil, there will be major volatility in the equity
yes.
markets, which will mean sell-offs. But generally, apart from one period where it looked like we were getting head and shoulders structure, I don't over-focus on calling reversals. And when we did call that reversal, we got spanked. It seemed the central banks got all behind. They had their February meeting with China and all of that. They all said, no, there's nothing wrong, and they bought the market back up. Either way, that idea failed. That trade idea failed. And it was punishment as well for contemplating a reversal. But there was a clear fundamental case and there was a technical setup. But reversals are what they are. They often fail. Apart from that, one thing I do need to say is that equities in the worst possible markets could still outshine many things. The fact that they're overvalued is overvalued relative to what? Everything is overvalued. Bonds are overvalued. Everything is overvalued. There's too much funny money chasing things, and equities could still be a refuge for a while before you get the real nitty-gritty of the crash.
Yeah.
And could go higher. So I don't advocate shorting equities. They can be wrong longer than you can be right. And if the price action isn't showing you that the weakness is now there and it's now gone too far and that money's found some other place to go because you only have certain options, which is more attractive. And if everyone switches to insurance and buys Bitcoin, gold and silver at around about the same time and switches out of stocks, you'll see it in the price behavior. But when you're making new highs or you're just off being close to all-time highs, it's not a seller's market, and so many retail traders just want to come in and short the FTSE, short the this. And then they were shorting the FTSE during the time that the pound was losing value,
yeah.
making the UK shares disproportionately good value in dollars and euros.
Yeah.
And they were doing this during the currency effect, and at the same time of an index that has a lot of metals miners in it when gold and silver was running. And then they kept getting handed their backside to them and wondering what's going on. And then we confuse, it's that old adage, it's they don't confuse the economy with the market. So where do you stand on equities and asset classes? Apart from, I think we agree on the insurance for the Great Reset being silver and gold and off system money. How do you feel about the current balance? Because there's people still saying continue to buy bonds. They'll continue to drop the rates for now. And that for me is kind of like trying to get the last 1 or 2% out of the end of a very long extended cycle. I feel it's a very dangerous game, although I think they'll be right for a while. But when they're wrong, boy, are they going to be bloody wrong.
Well, I mean, you're right. I mean, it's playing chicken with a truck, isn't it, really?
Yeah,
You
where
know,
do we
musical
stand on
chairs at
bonds?
one point. Yeah, I mean, look, if you honestly feel that giving the German government money to buy their debt for 10 years is a great investment, then good luck to you. I mean, that to me is, you're either saying that the nominal GDP growth in these countries is going to be incredibly low and obviously totally inconsistent with, you know, the 2% inflation targets that most central banks are running with, or you actually that's a play on saying that the euro isn't going to be around in 10 years' time, and actually I'm buying an asset which is going to be denominated in, you know, Neue Deutschmarks in the year 2026. But the problem is, you know, as you know, if we continue
But
to
with
push.
Deutsche Bank, potentially Germany on one hand is the strongest, and as you said, the trade, surplus and all of that. But on in other hands, it's also the most flawed with its bank, its German banks,
Yeah,
Commerce and
they're
Deutsche Bank.
connected.
So
Well, I mean,
actually,
yeah.
they're all rotten, but just in different ways. Germany at a trade and manufacturing and an exporting level is robust, but their banks are broken.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're actually connected because one of the things that Germany has, at least on paper, has been good at has been getting capital into real businesses, real industry. You know, you've got the Mittelstand in Germany. You don't have the same, perhaps the same
No, in
degree.
London, it all goes to the asset managers and the speculators.
Yeah, well,
That's
the
the
problem is.
difference. The Germans actually bank enterprise to develop products and build factories and plants.
Yeah.
And I think post reset and post banking reset, like the Deutsche Banks and Commerce Banks, they will be one of the quickest back up on their feet because they have a real innovation, they have a real entrepreneurship and capital provider mentality to
Yeah.
business, and they have a real capability in engineering, manufacturing, and they will export product again. It'll be
Yeah.
a much smaller world, and there'll be much less buyers around, but in some ways, there could be big buyers around. Who
Yeah.
knows? At some point, it'll come back strong again. Short of all the population being slaughtered, it's going to come back strong post reset when we have a financial system back in place. God knows who will piece that up. I think it'll be the people in the shadows who will be lying low while it gets a bit bumpy. But anyway, that's aside. They will be on their feet quicker than a services industry that sells legal work, consulting, and financial engineering.
Yeah. I mean, just to sort of come back to your original question, I mean, I still think the big picture is a grind lower. You know, we mentioned you know earlier on why
So you believe in their ability to do an orderly decline, and that at no point that people, whenever something is consistently going up, that everybody then leverage up and they chase it and it goes melt up. When
Yeah.
things are going consistently down, the same tends to apply. You believe that they will use market stabilizers and printed money to prevent a disorderly decline. Then
They're certainly going to try.
I think they're going to
No,
try. I do not see them succeeding in
I
that.
don't see them succeeding. So I think there will be a point of capitulation because ultimately you're not going to transition to plan B, even if I could identify what plan B might be at the moment for as far as policymakers are concerned, without a severe economic shock to the real economy. You know, earnings numbers coming down, credit spreads widening, fears of defaults in the credit space rising, and which would argue for a significant derating of financial assets. But you know, in the meantime, of course, you know, you've got mitigating factors, as you said. You know, well, you could say equities are expensive, but bonds are expensive. The problem with that relative, because you'll always find something which appears to be less expensive than something else. You know, and there's an argument there, of course, that oh right, when you're not risk adjusting it incorrectly and actually you're not being compensated for the additional risk you're taking on. But that aside, just because something is cheaper to something else doesn't mean you should be buying any of it. You know, because you have had this positive correlation, you tend to have increased correlations across asset classes, across
But
geographies.
most people don't see physical gold and silver as even an option. They've spent an entire generation where that never was an option. So their eyes aren't open to it. It's all paper assets. Yep. So well, that's where you then have relative valuations on paper assets. Yeah. I believe they'll all have an incredibly torrid time, but I think the bonds have to go to zero virtually. And maybe not German ones if they're rare, relative to American ones, and Germany extracts itself and continues to manufacture and construct, they'll avoid it. But most nations are going to hit the reset button with the opportunity, especially when you can hide it behind the globalized. You may remember Brown, how he globalized Britain's over-indebtedness and the subprime boom. It wasn't a UK thing, it was a global thing. You know, his light touch regulation and all that stuff he did. The perfect excuse of it wasn't me, this is black swan event, way bigger than all of us, who could have seen it coming, the tidal wave smashed us, there was no preparation, they're all going to take refuge there, like Greenspan and all these other little mutts have already shown us. They don't do accountability, they add to the problem, they continue to add to the problem, and they say after me the storm. And they know that, and they hope not to be holding the hand grenade when the 10th second ticks.
But that's part of the problem, Francis. I think I'm glad you mentioned that G20, which I think it was January. Was it Mexico?
It was February. We were falling like an absolute stone during January.
So I think they have to be pushed to this point of crisis before everybody gets onto the same page and actually does something. Now, I would argue again that they bought themselves time and then did the wrong thing, but at least there was agreement about something and there was action.
Bad action. Because, keep on keeping on with the corruption and the funny money game.
I think because there has been a measure of success, certainly compared to
delay. Delay the eventual and you make it bigger. It's kind of like putting your finger in the wall of the dike in the Dutch analogy. You stop the flooding of the village, but it's non-feasible, non-viable, and not a long-term solution, and the pressure just builds even higher.
Absolutely, which is why, there is going to be a break. There is going to be when we come back to this, if it can't go on forever, it must end. This cannot go on forever. We, in terms of economic policy, we're at a complete dead end.
Yeah.
And, whether that's, that realization occurs in 3 months' time or 3 years' time. And I can't imagine we'll be talking about 10 years' time. That's for sure.
I can't see the 3 years, but then, 5 or 6 years ago, I would have thought it would be close to being up 5 or 6 years' time, around about now. So I do feel this is a pivotal year.
Yeah,
I didn't feel 15 was. I haven't come into every year saying this is the year. It's a pivotal year. I feel something about the election cycle in America, the Brexit, and all that's going on here. It may end up that all the carnage runs through 17 if it is the pivotal year, and 17 will be remembered. But this will be 2007. Maybe 17 is the 08. But it's the topping. If that makes any sense, or it's the beginning of the decline, disorderly decline, that could be 2-3 years down the road, but we'll already have declined a long way by then.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, going back to, something I said, I think right at the start was, I think a lot of this is being pushed back into the political sphere, and it comes at a particularly sensitive point in the, as you mentioned, the electoral cycle. You've got US elections. You've got elections in France. You've got elections in Germany next year. And I'll just throw this one thing out. And I'm probably unwise in doing so this late in the day. But I was very interested to see Greece's finance minister, Euclid Tsakalotos, me showing off there, and also Pierre Moscovici, who's the European Commission for Economic Affairs.
Great verbal dexterity, Mike.
I know. I'll never be able to do that on the second take. both saying that they wanted a deal on Greek debt forgiveness by the end of this year. And this is interesting because, of course, in the early part of June, Greece got bunged 7.5 billion euros to effectively keep it out of the headlines ahead of the UK vote. And it was generally thought that put that to bed at least until 2018, after the elections in France and Germany were out of the way. And in fact, Wolfgang Schäuble, who's the German finance minister, actually came out and said, We won't discuss anything debt forgiveness until 2018 after these elections, just confirming that it was really politics as much as economics that was driving this process. So for them now to put this back on the table for the end of this year, I'm wondering what on earth's going on, because we've seen how Greece has had the ability to seriously accept markets. And of course, it's just the tip of the iceberg in terms of the issues that it represents. But I would certainly argue that the world is in a significantly worse place than it was when it last upset markets last summer. So I would just keep an eye on that. I mean, I've never taken my eye off Greece, because it's, again, that's one part of the huge list of problems which are never solved. But that one suddenly seems to have moved up the queue.
Reflared up again. And it is the bellwether for the rest of them. Mike, I want to call it a day at this. This has been awesome. I'm going to leave, I think, on a positive note. Go and enjoy your life. Who knows what's coming our way? Enjoy your life. Do things now. Enjoy the simple things. Might be a plan of action. And start stacking that silver. We keep saying the same conclusion and gold. Get your insurance policies in right. Maybe have a plan. I know I've spoken to you. You've got family that's a little bit out the country if ever you needed it. What else should someone do as a positive proactive to seize back control over the fact that they're going to have this major economic event inflicted over them at a key part of their lifetime?
On a lifestyle perspective, I'd say get yourself fit.
Be physically fit. Yes.
Physical and mental resilience, because you know you can't assume that the infrastructure is going to be there to carry you around.
I will add to that. Acquire an interest in clay pigeon shooting, and the required tool of a shotgun could prove a most fun, leisurely pursuit, and who knows, might come in handy.
Well, exactly. But I was quite interested. Over the last few months, I've got quite into the comedian, US comedian Bill Burr, and yes. he has a similar take on, I think, the big picture as we have, although he's a comedian rather than looking at financial markets. And all he was saying was, well, it's all very well to be gathering these resources for when it all goes down. He said, but unless you can protect yourself, you're just gathering it for some other guy.
Exactly. Some other bigger guy who just worried about the gun bit and said that'll take care of everything else.
Exactly.
Absolutely. Mike Ingram, entertaining and interesting and intriguing, spot on. Thank you for coming on. Great.
My pleasure,
great
as always, Francis.
Have a good evening, and we'll speak again soon.
Yeah, you take care. All the best.
Bye-bye.